Jonathan Potter, represent the appellant, Specialist Richard Gifford. The Army Court erred in holding that the 2nd Infantry Division policy letter imposed strict liability for two reasons. First, traditional adversarial principles and notions of fundamental fairness prohibited the Army Court from imposing strict liability on appeal. And second, even if this court finds that the Army Court had the ability to impose strict liability on appeal, it was error to do so in this case because the policy should not be interpreted as regulating a public welfare offense. As to the first point, all parties at the trial agreed that knowledge as to age was a requirement. Again, on appeal, all parties agreed that knowledge was a requirement. When Specialist Gifford filed his brief before the Army Court alleging factual insufficiency regarding knowledge, the government responded and agreed that knowledge was a requirement, but argued it had met its burden.
Counsel, how do you deal with the principle that I think everybody agrees with, that a lawful general order, an individual doesn't even need to know about it, doesn't have to have notice of it to be convicted of it? So if he doesn't have to be convicted, or he doesn't have to have notice of a lawful general order, obviously he can't know what it says, so how can he then be held not to, or to have intent?
Your Honor, while knowledge of the order is not a defense, nor is required that the government prove he knew of the order, the underlying order itself and what it is criminalizing, when a commander is acting under his authority to create a punitive order, he is acting as a legislature. So he is creating a crime, and in doing so, he is held to the same standards of any other lawmaker in constructing what is essentially a criminal statute. So whether or not Specialist Gifford knew of the order is irrelevant to the issue of what the actual crime that the commander created here encompassed. Here, strict liability was not mentioned in this case as an issue until the Army Court created it. Only then did the government change course on appeal and argue that it was the correct.
If that's proper law, then how are you harmed by the fact that the proper law was not found until that point? Because if it was error to think that scienter of the sort that knows of the age of the receiving party is required, if it's incorrect to impose that burden, so there was a heavier burden imposed upon the prosecution than the law would impose, so how are you harmed by the higher court discovering the principle later?
Your Honor, the harm to the appellant did not occur at trial. It occurred on appeal.
But how is that? I mean, Judge Santel is asking you a very sensible question, which is, at trial, they were held to the standard that they had to prove scienter, right? That they had to prove that he knew that they were under 21.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? And you'd agree that that's harder to do than just to prove that they were 21.
Correct, Your Honor. However, an appellate court in exercising its Article 66 powers, as this court long ago recognized in Zimmerman, is only taking action under Article 66 for the benefit of the appellant. They cannot prejudice the appellant through those actions.
But how is it prejudiced?
Here, the...
I mean, they didn't find, for example, I mean, they found that it was legally insufficient with respect to the one person because they were not, there was no evidence that they were under 21. They made no legal sufficiency finding with respect to the other people, did they?
No, Your Honor, they did not make
the
factual.
They glided all over because they, I guess, decided they wanted to reach this issue that they didn't need to reach?
Well, it's a safe assumption from the record, from what the Army Court did, is that the evidence was factually insufficient under
doesn't
the theory.
Doesn't say anything, but they didn't hold that. They didn't find that, and I don't agree that that's the case.
Well, Your Honor, they didn't find that it was factually insufficient under the theory presented to the panel. However, they changed the theory of which was presented to the panel. Strict liability, while a service court can affirm on a lesser included offense, they cannot do so on a theory not presented to the panel. And strict liability cannot be said to be a lesser included offense.
Well, maybe not a lesser included offense, but it's a shorter list of elements. To find under the burden that included scienter, they had to find they were under 21 and the defendant knew it.
Correct.
Under the interpretation applied by the appellate court, they had to find he was under 21, whether or not the defendant knew it. So they had to find an additional fact under the erroneous standard applied by the trial court. So how are you harmed by the appellate court coming up with a different standard on appeal. I'm not yet seeing the prejudice.
The harm to Specialist Gifford here was, had the situation been reversed and Specialist Gifford was trying to attack the instruction provided by the military judge, waiver would have been found, and waiver should have been found here for the government. They agreed at trial that this was the correct instruction and it encompassed the correct standard.
Well, and he was convicted by the members in accordance with that instruction. So, I mean, I guess in some respects, my question is, why are you here? You lose either way. I mean, you lose under either standard.
It's not clear, Your Honor, that we do lose either way under either standard because the Army Court never conducted its factual sufficiency review with regards to the standard submitted to the panel. So this court should remand back to the Army Court to conduct a factual sufficiency review under the standard that the panel deliberated on, not on a strict liability standard. They made no finding with regards to factual sufficiency under a specific intent theory. So if this court does not think that waiver should apply here, at the very least, the Army Court should have looked at the instruction under a plain error standard, which is what Specialist Gifford would have been afforded had he not objected to the instruction. And while a CCA doesn't have to apply waiver and has a carte blanche authority to do justice, and has been described as the 800-pound gorilla in the room, there are places where that 800-pound gorilla is not free to roam. The party presentation principles discussed in Green Law, there is no exception to those provided through Article 66, and nor does it encompass the ability to take action to the detriment of the accused. Article 66.
But how was it detrimental to the accused to hold this prosecution to a higher burden than the burden that they should have under what the ACCA found to be the, held to be the law? What they did wrong at trial was make the prosecution prove more than they had to prove, wasn't it?
Right. That is not, the detriment to the accused did not occur at trial. It occurred on appeal, where Article 66 is the device by which Congress has adopted ensuring that an accused does not stand convicted on an inadequate record. He did not get his full.
But if we agree with the appellate military court that scienter is not an element, then there's no error in the court of appeal, right? You have nothing left, do you, at that point?
If this court looks at the policy and interprets it as a strict liability offense, then no.
Okay.
Moving on to the second point, that this court should not interpret it as a strict liability offense, it should be noted from the outset that all cases where the court has found an offense to be a public welfare offense have only done so after the appellant was convicted at trial under a theory of strict liability. No case is in turning a public an offense into a public welfare offense when the accused was convicted under a theory of specific intent. In determining whether an offense should be interpreted as a public welfare offense, the Supreme Court in Staples looked to three factors. First, the nature of the item regulated. Second, the expectations that individuals may have in dealing with the item. And third, the penalties imposed for a violation of the regulation. Here, all three factors favor Specialist Gifford. Alcohol in the hands of minors is not inherently dangerous, nor do we treat it as such in the United States or in the military.
Why is it illegal to sell it to them?
Well, while all states do have laws regarding underage drinking and furnishing alcohol to minors,
you think it's for no reason?
24 of the states, Your Honor, expressly include an intent requirement on the part of the individual furnishing the alcohol.
26 don't.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So 26 don't?
Well, of the remaining 26, only 8 of those can truly be said to be a potential public welfare offense, as they do not provide a parental exception. The parental exception is important to note.
What about for people that sell alcohol?
Selling alcohol, yes, Your Honor, that is generally a strict liability offense because the person selling the alcohol has put themselves in a position where they are dealing with the public and the law imposes a duty on them to ascertain the criminality of their actions. Items that have been
found. Why on a military base and a military barracks with military personnel, can't we treat it the same way?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Why, when it's involving military members, can't it be treated the same way?
Well, Your Honor, the military doesn't treat it as such. Service members serving overseas at 18 years of age and older can drink and purchase alcohol. So, and here, this unit does not treat it as such, as the, at the time of trial, this policy had been rescinded. Second, while alcohol is generally subject to a multitude of regulations, they are not that intrusive. As I said, most of the regulations do provide an intent or provide a parental exception.
They're not intrusive?
Yes, the court... The
alcohol regulation in this country is one of the most bizarre things imaginable. You've got the hangover from Prohibition. You've got 50 different ways of doing it. You've got a uniform national drinking age only because Congress has the hammer of highway money. Before that came in, you had a multitude of ages. It's anything but simple and straightforward.
Yes, but if we look at all of the statutes regarding throughout the states, all 24 of them require some form of intent. It's not a strict liability crime. The other ones have a parental exception except for 8. The parental exception, if we truly treated this as dangerous to the public welfare, we would not allow a parent to
Why that follows. That seems to me to be a non-sequitur. We can think that it is a danger to the public, but think that if parents are involved, persons of mature age are involved in the decision-making, the danger is not so great that society can't put up with it. It doesn't follow that it's not a public welfare offense just because there's a parental exception, does it?
Well, Your Honor, it does cut against it if we're allowing an individual that the public has deemed that this action is so dangerous to the public welfare that we're not going to require a mens rea on the part of the individual, that we would allow just a parent to make that decision to endanger the welfare.
Somebody's making the decision that it's the minors can or cannot have alcohol. In the first instance, the legislative body makes the decision. In this case, a commanding officer makes the decision with reference to the general circumstance. Then the second level of decision can say, well, that danger can be alleviated if parents are involved in the decision as to whether or not the kid gets alcohol, so we will make an exception where the parents are doing it. That doesn't deprive the first cut decision of validity, does it?
Well, Your Honor, in looking at things in other offenses that have been deemed public welfare offenses, no such exceptions are included in those.
So what?
Because of the
so what? This is an exception. We know that when we start. So you're telling me, well, this is exceptional. Yes, it's exceptional, but I do not see why it could not be a rational legislative decision to say, okay, we're going to say that kids can't be out here drinking alcohol. However, if the parents want the kid to have it at Passover, for example, parents are in a position to make the decision whether the danger is worth it in that case or not. So why would that be irrational?
Your Honor, it cuts against the fact that one individual could make a decision that undermines the welfare of the public if it was treated as inherently dangerous. Lastly, the penalty for violating this policy weighs in favor of interpreting it with a mens rea. While the Supreme Court has not adopted a definitive rule of construction regarding penalties imposed for public welfare offenses, the Supreme Court in Staples emphasized that severe penalties is a further factor tending to suggest that the lawmaker did not intend to dispense with a mens rea requirement.
Counsel, if we agree with you that mens rea is an element, what do we do? What do we do procedurally with this case, since it was tried under the theory that you advance? What are we supposed to do here?
The only thing this court can do is remand it back to the Army Court to conduct its Article 66 review under the standard with a mens rea. Because they did not address whether the record was factually sufficient with regards to the intent theory put forth at trial, the only thing this court can do is send it back for that review. Pending any further questions?
Okay, thank you. Can I hear from the government?
Good morning, Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court. My name is Captain Robin Chatwood, and I, along with Major John Choike, represent the government in this matter. This court should affirm the Army Court's decision that a mens rea was not required for the provision, as one, it was in accordance with the plain language of the lawful order, in the scheme of the Article 92 offenses, and the nature of the prohibited conduct. Where a law is silent as to mens rea, the default rule is to read in mens rea. But courts will dispose of mens rea after analysis of the language and the type of conduct prohibited.
So why is this conduct not more like possession of a gun, right, as opposed to possession of a hand grenade? Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like, so we have hand grenades, narcotics, bad, right? Guns, not so bad as to be strict liability. Why isn't alcohol more like a gun than it is like a hand grenade or narcotics?
Well, Your Honor, the right to possess guns is found under the Constitution, where the right to possess alcohol is not. And so under this instance, we're regulating a type of item that is necessarily, by its effect on people, it causes impairment, potentially dangerous, potentially harmful to a person. Alcohol can certainly go from some type of mind-altering type of substance all the way to substantial incapacitation, which is what occurred in this case. So a court will look to the nature of the conduct to determine whether a mens rea should be
I'm sorry, I don't follow your answer to Judge Ryan at all.
I mean, it doesn't really answer my question, which is what makes it more like a hand grenade than like a gun? And don't give me the Second Amendment, please. I'm talking about the nature of the item.
Well, there's been a long history of regulation for alcohol.
And a long nature of regulation of guns.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe we're discussing the case involving where a gun was changed, and when the rifle was changed to be an automatic machine gun, the court found that a mens rea should have been included because a person wouldn't have known that the nature of the gun had made it actually prohibited. So the person had held a gun that was lawful.
Well, I think that they focused right on the fact that there were both lawful and unlawful uses of guns, right? And as opposed to hand grenades, what did they think there?
Well, hand grenades are not something that is lawful, and so under the law, so harboring
ever,
the hand grenade,
right,
is not something that is acceptable. And so here we're talking about alcohol.
So people should know, right, that a hand grenade isn't legal to have.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this instance, alcohol is legal to control if you are over the age limit of 21. And so the question is.
That begs the question of whether it should be strict liability or not.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this analysis, the court, as in other courts, would go through and look at the nature of the item being distributed. So the question is whether a person can distribute alcohol to somebody under 21, and would they have had to know? And the answer is no. They would not have had to know based on the language of this provision, as well as the statutory or the scheme of an Article 92.
Okay. As a matter of statutory construction, how do you get that answer?
When looking at the provision, and we look at the plain language first, the lawmaker, the commander, read in an actus reus, included a specific intent for the purpose of consumption, and then intentionally left out, omitted the mens rea of knowledge of age.
But what do we make of the fact that no one at trial, right, including the command representative, understood it that way?
Well, this was a, certainly strict liability offenses or public welfare offenses are unique, and in this instance, this was a non-prejudicial misinterpretation of the law. The military judge.
But that doesn't answer my question, which is you're saying that that he left it out intentionally, and I'm saying, well, what are we to make of the fact that at trial, the command representative, the trial counsel, didn't understand it that way? Do you see the difference of the question I'm asking you as opposed to the answer you're giving me?
The trial counsel would not have spoken for the lawmaker. The trial prosecutor doesn't have the ability to remove or add elements to an offense. Here, the military judge interpreted the law.
I'm talking about their understanding, the fact that they understood it that way. And he is a command representative, the trial counsel.
They are
just like a district attorney represents the United States government.
And yes, Your Honor, a prosecutor is responsible for the procedural correctness at court and during trial. And then a military judge is the person who determines or reviews the law. And in this instance,
everybody agreed that intent was necessary, and they all agreed on the instruction, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but
can't the military judge rely on what the trial counsel tells them on behalf of the government?
The military judge is the person who determines the review of the law. So they don't necessarily have to rely on what the trial counsel determines.
But they all agreed.
If you're here, you asked him.
They all agreed, and presumably this issue had come up before in this circuit, right, before this military judge or his colleagues or his friends. I mean, I'm speculating, but I doubt that this was an issue of first impression.
Yes, Your Honor, and it's as if this is a question like if, in this instance, the military judge added an element or gave the appellant the ability to present a defense, an affirmative defense in some way, and in that way it would be non-prejudicial. So the court, in the acceptance of like a jury instruction, doesn't preclude appellate courts from determining the merits of the instruction, and the law of the case does not apply to an instruction that exceeds the requirements of the law.
Right, but you're going back to like why we should read this instruction to clearly evidence an intent by the part of the commander to leave out a mens rea. And everything you're talking about isn't answering that question.
Your Honor, so to answer the question, the assertions of the trial counsel do not bind the appellate court's review of the law.
That's not the question. The question is, what as a matter of statutory construction advances your position? You started by saying, well, he said mens rea over here, but he didn't say it over here, so the plain meaning is X. And then the obvious question is, why then did the command's representative, the defense counsel, and the judge all agree that that is not the case?
It was a misinterpretation of the law, Your Honor. And on appeal, this was corrected by the Army Court.
Well, especially since the issue wasn't even raised on appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
They corrected it, if anything, sua sponte.
Yes, Your Honor. And the correction that they made was something that was proper, and it was properly done.
Well, what's your response to the argument that the CCA affirmed on a theory that the charge wasn't tried under?
Well, it is not a change in the theory because the offense wouldn't have changed, the charge sheet wouldn't have changed, the specification that was charged. The facts that would have been presented at trial would not have changed.
Well, going from a strict liability offense to a non-strict liability offense seems to me to be a change.
Because at trial there was an additional element that was added, and based on the Army Court's decision, that element was removed, there is no change in the theory of the case. This is not like the conclusion, now, appellant cites to Zimmerman, where they say that appellant cannot be subject to final action that is more to his detriment than the original action of court-martial, but this is in relation to an offense that is greater than what was originally charged.
It's a different theory. Whether it prejudices the appellant's another matter, but it's a different theory. It's a wholly different statutory theory.
You seem to be arguing prejudice, that he wasn't prejudiced by the change, not whether or not there was a change in theory.
Our argument, Your Honor, is that the theory would not have changed because not the facts that would have been elicited or presented at trial or what the defense had to defend against wouldn't have changed.
Why shouldn't you argue prejudice instead of that? Why shouldn't you be saying to us, even if it's true that it's a different theory, there's no prejudice?
That is a point to be made, Your Honor, but at this point, the Army Court did not find for or against factual sufficiency as to mens rea. So the question of prejudice is not something that we focus on here.
Counsel, do you agree with appellant's counsel that if we disagree with the CCA that this is a strict liability offense, that procedurally what has to happen is it has to go back to the CCA for a factual sufficiency review?
Yes, Your Honor, because there was not factual sufficiency that was found at the CCA. Your Honor, as to interpreting a general order, interpreting a general order falls under an Article 92 violation as determined in Leverett to be of a scheme of strict liability, and the factors weigh in favor of removing or disposing the mens rea. Factors that weigh in favor of disposing of a mens rea when analyzing a public welfare offense are whether the offense was a malum prohibitum offense, whether the law was made to protect the public health, whether it was designed to protect minors, if there is a focus on achievement of social betterment, just as general orders are. They are reactive. They are reactive to some type of problem or issue in a unit, and they are made quickly. And in this instance, we are in a location that is just south of the 38th parallel. We're in an area where a Unit 2ID is in an alliance with South Korea, and there's an armistice, so an ongoing war. There are heightened tensions, and so necessarily the commander could have determined, it was in their authority, that a strict liability offense was necessary. And it's not uncommon because often general orders are strict liability offenses. If you look to general orders in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, we regulate strictly personally owned vehicles, personally owned weapons. We strictly regulate alcohol, sex. We strictly regulate the conduct of soldiers in these type of situations. Does it have to be in this type of situation? No, but it's in a commander's authority to do that.
The regulations that you're referring to in other locations, do we know whether or not they specifically include a strict liability language?
Some of them do, but some of them don't. And I haven't cited to them in my brief, but I can say that in the location that we're talking about, there was a general order that was enacted, and the general order was curfew.
Well, I don't think anyone is denying the power of commanders to issue general orders. It does, however, raise an interesting question. This isn't a DA regulation. This is not promulgated by the Secretary Concerned. This is promulgated by a local commander who also happens to be the convening authority. And one would expect that when the representative of the convening authority, who is also the commander promulgating the order, comes into court and says, there's a mens rea element, Your Honor, and Your Honor says, thank you very much, that would bear some weight.
It's a factor to be considered, Your Honor. But certainly in this instance, the appellate court...
Did the CCA consider it?
It's not articulated in their opinion.
Doesn't seem to be.
It's not something that would outweigh the factors that relate to disposing or the factors that weigh in favor of disposing of a mens rea. So although there was some obvious confusion at the trial court level, the factors that weigh in favor in this instance, based on the language, based on an Article 92 strict liability offense, and based on the nature of the conduct.
Well, what exactly is your point with regard to Article 92?
So when you look at the scheme of the regulation, so you're looking at the scheme of the provision, which is another principle of construction statutory interpretation.
Well, that's exactly like the first point. It's the same point. Does, as a matter, you know, I ask you, what as a matter of statutory construction leads you in the direction you're trying to go, and you try to answer it, and I don't think that Article 92 adds anything to that.
Okay, Your Honor. The idea is that there's a consistent scheme. So there's a consistent scheme. It is clear.
Article 92 exists, as I understand it, to make criminally enforceable valid punitive regulations. And, of course, they've got to be punitive. But that includes both those requiring mens rea and those not. So
yes.
Where does that leave us?
It's not to say that all general orders would not have a mens rea. But in this instance, when trying to determine that if a law is silent as to mens rea, how to get around or get past that default rule, the court does an analysis, and they do typically do an analysis to determine why. And in the instance of a public welfare offense, based on the factors listed and previously articulated, the mens rea would have been disposed of. So in this instance, when analyzing a general order that is silent as to mens rea, the court would find that the mens rea should be disposed of.
Should the Supreme Court's recent decision in Alanis inform our thoughts on this matter?
No, Your Honor.
Or if so, not. Or why not?
Well, because we're discussing...
I realize it's not raised as an issue.
Well, because we're discussing conduct that is... it's not wholly impassive conduct, so we're not talking about wholly impassive conduct. This is conduct that is not protected by the Constitution. We're not talking about communications of a threat. We're talking about something that when a person holds this item...
Wait a minute. Certainly the possession of alcohol, the consumption of alcohol is protected by the Constitution, because in 1919, when they tried to prohibit it, they had to amend the Constitution.
Well, the question,
and then when they put it back, they had to de-amend the Constitution. It sounds like it's got some constitutional protection.
Well, we're looking at the act of giving alcohol to someone.
Okay, fair enough.
And, Your Honor, so turning to the statutory interpretation, so the government is looking at the plain language, and we look at the nature of the offense, and then we turn and say the language or the mens rea should be disposed of. For those reasons, Your Honor, the government asks that the members of the panel, or finds that the members of the panel of the Army Court correctly found the appellant assumed the risk of violating the general order when he gave alcohol to others, and applying a mens rea would constitute a judicial overreach. Here, the plain language and the scheme of an Article 92 offense, along with the commander's authority and responsibility to the unit and to the public, similar to a public welfare offense, weighs in favor of disposing of a mens rea. As such, under these circumstances and given the specific language of this particular general order, the offense did not include a knowledge of age requirement. Accordingly, this court should find no error and affirm the Army Court's decision. Subject to your questions.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Very brief, Your Honor. Specialist Gifford is not arguing that a commander could not promulgate a general order imposing strict liability. We are simply arguing that when he does so, he must give some indication in the policy that it is strict liability. And to answer your question, Judge Stuckey, yes, Alanis should control in this instance when dealing with interpreting this general order. Alanis, while it was a free speech case dealing with the First Amendment right, it was more accurately described as a statutory construction case and gave rules for interpreting statutes. And lastly, criminal statutes should be strictly construed. And when there's any ambiguity, that ambiguity should be resolved in favor of the appellant. And here, the fact that three lawyers in that courtroom looked at this policy and read it as requiring a mens rea at least creates some ambiguity, and that ambiguity should be resolved in Specialist Gifford's favor. Pending any further questions.
Thank you. Case has been submitted. The court will now stand in recess until further order of the court.